All right, Alexander, let's do an update as to what's going on in the Middle East. Got a lot of news from the Middle East. Interesting news. The first big thing is a rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia is in the cards. What's going on here?
Well, this is a huge move. Now, the Saudis and the Iranians have been talking to each other privately in Baghdad for some time. There have been four rounds of talks. But what has now happened is that they're opening representative offices in each other's capitals. And we've learned that Iranian diplomats are now heading to Riyadh so that they will actually be physically present in Saudi, and the Saudis presumably in Iran too. And the next step, and apparently that's only a short distance off, is for these representative offices to be upgraded to full-fledged embassies. Now, Saudi Arabia and Iran broke off diplomatic relations in 2016. So they've now been, they've severed their relations for 6 years. Over the course of that time, relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran became poisonous. There was talk about war between the two countries. Now it seems that Iran and Saudi Arabia are busy patching things up. So that is a major move. It is clearly the Saudis who've taken this big decision that they're going to repair their relations with Iran. And the talk is that this is now going to be followed up by, well, we know that there's going to be a visit by the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to Moscow within the next few days or weeks. All the talk is that there's going to be a document signed over the course of that visit, whereby the Russians and the Iranians will enter into a strategic cooperation agreement. And the fact that Saudi Arabia, with which Russia has, you know, complicated but generally cordial relations, they have they work with each other to keep the oil price stable. So the fact that the Saudis are now mending their fences with Iran is widely expected to mean that it will open the door now for a big Russian arms deal with Iran. The Russians have been unwilling to sell arms on a big scale to Iran because they've been concerned not to create tensions or problems with the Saudis. But with that now coming together, the Russians will now have the green light to sell arms to Iran. And the arms that are being talked about are jet fighters. Iran's air force is a mess. It's a hodgepodge of fighter planes left over from the time of the Shah, supplemented with old Soviet aircraft, basically taken over from Saddam Hussein. And they want, obviously, the Iranians need to upgrade that and to bring some kind of coherence to their air force. And the story is that there's a big arms deal coming for Sukhoi fighter jets, Sukhoi 30 or Sukhoi 35 fighter jets, which the Russians will now supply to Iran. So that will change the military geography of the Middle East and the political geography also. It's likely there will also be some kind of deal done, I suspect, to try to dial down the Yemen war, where which has been intensifying, by the way, over the last few weeks.
Is this about arms sales? Is that why you have a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, just for the arms sales? What's in it for Saudi Arabia?
What's their angle
outside of Yemen? Okay, the Yemen war, I can see it as an off ramp for Saudi Arabia to finally get out of that situation that they put themselves in. But what else is there for Saudi Arabia? Because the U.S. is not going to take too kindly to this.
No, it's not. But you see, the problem is that it's U.S. policy that has, to a great extent, brought this about. Two things have happened which have caused the Saudis to reassess the importance of their relationship with the U.S. They're not going to cease to have a good relationship, or at least a semi-alliance relationship with the U.S., but they've now decided that they can't rely on the U.S. in the way that they once thought they could. And those two things are these. Firstly, if you remember going back to, I think it was 2018, there was a drone attacks. There were drone attacks on Saudi oil installations. The drones were supposed to come from Yemen. Many people, including myself, believe that the Iranians had a hand in it. It became very clear that Saudi air defences were not up to dealing with those drones. And the Saudis came to the US. They looked for support and help to counter these Iranian drones. And though that help was not really forthcoming, not in any effective way. And that meant that the Saudis, who were obviously very concerned about their oil industry, became concerned about that. But all of that has been overshadowed by the debacle in Afghanistan last summer. It showed to the Saudis the fact that the US not only withdrew from Afghanistan, but botched its withdrawal, has had a massive effect across the Middle East. It's made many countries in the Middle East say to themselves, well, the United States cannot be relied upon. It can't even handle a withdrawal effectively. So this means that the US is not a reliable partner. It means that we now have to start patching up our relations with our neighbours. It means that we've got to rein in our foreign policy. And that means that we've got to start to think about doing deals with our adversary, which is, of course, Iran. It hasn't helped matters that US foreign policy towards Iran is a mass of contradictions. So the United States, having apparently taken a really hard line against Iran under the Trump administration, then under Biden, swerved towards perhaps trying to seek some kind of rapprochement with Iran, but then has muddled and failed to see that through effectively either. And there's always, in addition, a personal dimension, which is that MBS, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, was extremely angry with the way in which the United States, when the new administration took over, essentially named him as the person who was responsible for the Khashoggi murder. Now, that might have been entirely true, but MBS didn't take kindly to that. So he's got a particular beef now with Biden personally and with the Democrats. And that's also making him, I think, personally reassess his foreign policy.
Right. Is there still a threat of war between Israel and Iran? Is
that absolutely still, absolutely
there? And that because it seemed to be ramping up
absolutely
like about a month ago, but now it seems to have, I don't know, the past couple of weeks things have kind of seemed to have ticked down a little bit. But
well we don't really know exactly what's going on, and the voices coming out of Israel are contradictory. But of course the fact that Saudi Arabia, which has been Israel's de facto ally in this campaign against Iran, seems to be patching up its relations with Iran, might actually, to some extent, dampen Israeli enthusiasm for airstrikes on Iran. It's also becoming increasingly clear that the Israelis are finding that when they talk to the Americans about the ideas of airstrikes on Iran, they are faced again with a divided administration. Some people in the US administration seem to support that idea. Others oppose it. So again, we have the problem of a US administration that can't get its act together, can't come up with a clear focus policy on Iran. And that's making countries like Saudi Arabia and Israel pause. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, they're working towards patching up relations with Iran. In the case of Israel, well, one sense is that it's causing divisions within Israel itself between hardliners who think that a strike on Iran is the way forward and more realists who think that perhaps this is the point where the US is going to re-enter the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is going to do some kind of deal with Iran. And in light of that, the idea of a strike on Iran really isn't on the agenda. So we see divisions in Israel, a reassessment of policy in Saudi Arabia, all of these the product of the frankly confused and, dare I say, weak administration in Washington, which isn't able to chart a clear course and gives the impression also of being fundamentally uninterested in the Middle East.
Yeah, it seems like the confusion of the Biden White House, the fact that it is so confused and can't chart a clear course, is actually working out to the benefit of the Middle East, because for the first time in a long time, these countries are now saying, okay, the U.S. Leadership is so incompetent that we have to take matters into our own hands. And that's why you're seeing at least activity, you know, start to take place. I mean, diplomatic activity is for the first time in a long time actually appears to be, you know, working towards some sort of end result. But maybe the incompetence in this instance,
yeah,
of the Biden White House has actually worked out towards the benefit of the Middle East. I mean, in Syria, for example, you sent me an article before we did this video that, you know, it even looks like that that the U.S. is so confused in general as to the picture, yes, of the Middle East and, yes, with Syria, that they're now starting to withdraw from there as well. And,
yes,
as they're withdrawing from Syria, that's what it seems like they're withdrawing. As they're withdrawing from Syria, you know, we're seeing that Syria is starting to better its position on the world,
yeah,
stage, and it's starting to actually now get back into the world profile as well, the world stage as well. I mean, they're joining certain institutions, organizations. They're aligning with China. You know, they're striking diplomatic relations with other countries in the Middle East. You know, the confusion of Biden is actually, in my opinion, maybe you have a different viewpoint, actually maybe a blessing in disguise in this instance.
I think that is absolutely right. We have actually discussed this before on the Duran. We've done programs about this, which is that far from the US ascendancy over the Middle East, at least in the last couple of years, being a force for peace and stability, as some people in Washington and the think tanks like to claim, it's actually, because it's been driven so much by neocon obsessions, it's become instead a force for instability and for potential war. Remember, after all, it was the United States that launched wars in Syria, invaded Iraq, created a war in Libya. I mean, it supported a war in Yemen. This is hardly a country that has brought peace or stability to the Middle East. So the fact that the United States is starting to pull back, and we'll come to Syria in a moment, but the fact that the United States is starting to pull back, it's exactly what we said. We said this, by the way, shortly after the new administration came to power in the United States, that what's now happening is that the regional powers are now starting to cut deals with each other because they don't have to think about the United States all the time. And that is actually, at least for the moment, a good thing. Now, if we turn to Syria, the United States has had this policy, which is a neocon policy, of maintaining troops in Syria. Not large numbers, but enough to complicate the situation in Syria to keep the Syrian war going. Now, there was no really coherent strategy behind this. It just created instability. And of course, it was also backed by this massive sanctions campaign to try and strangle the Syrian economy and to provoke a crisis and to cause, ultimately, I suppose, the collapse of the Syrian government, which for the neocons remains an obsession. What has now happened is three things, all in conjunction with each other. Firstly, those American troops in Syria are becoming increasingly isolated and they're becoming increasingly targeted. And there's been articles, for example, I sent you one published by the Brookings Institution, which pointed out that one of these garrisons, the garrison at Al-Tanf, is now in effect surrounded. Resupply is incredibly precarious because there are no roads, there are no good roads, and there is no airstrip there. So they have to send basically convoys of people across the desert in what, you know, in four-wheel drive vehicles to try to keep this this garrison going. And the garrison itself is now increasingly finding that it's coming under pressure, that it's coming under attacks from various people. And that's also true of US troops elsewhere. And the result is a quiet drawdown, apparently, that's been going on now for some time, of US troops from Syria. The US is quietly starting to pull troops out of Syria. Remember when Donald Trump tried to do the same thing? There was this huge outrage about it and complaints about it in Congress. Donald Trump realised those troops weren't doing anything useful. And he also realised that they were becoming increasingly isolated and their position was becoming increasingly precarious. Well, he's gone, and yet the policy that he tried to implement is now being carried out in a quiet way. So the US is pulling gradually, step by step, it's gradually pulling out of Syria. And what's happening in the meantime is that Syria has now been admitted by China into the Belt and Road Initiative, which will be a vehicle for the Chinese to pour money into Syria, in effect circumventing the US sanctions. So that sanctions war is now coming to an end. The Saudis and the other Gulf states and Jordan are now starting to rebuild their relations with Syria. And the story is that Saudi Arabia is about to also re-establish relations with Syria. There is talk that Syria might be readmitted to the Arab League in March. And of course, the moment Syria is readmitted to the Arab League, then this policy of trying to destabilize and overthrow the Syrian government begins to become politically impossible. Because at that point, with Syria readmitted into the Arab League, American troops in Syria are occupiers of Arab land. American sanctions on Syria are sanctions against an Arab nation backed by the other Arab nations. And that whole policy starts to become untenable. And this all these moves taken together, the Saudis patching up relations with the Iranians, the moves around Syria, they're clearly connected with each other. They're another sign that the Saudis and others in the Arab world have reached, that the United States is retreating, that to the extent that it has a foreign policy, it is one that is now almost entirely focused on China and on the crisis in Europe, that it's not interested in the Middle East anymore, that it's not able to make big moves in the Middle East anymore. And so the moment has come for the Saudis and for other states to start cutting deals, patching up the situation, looking to build bridges to the former adversaries in Tehran and Damascus. And of course, as you rightly say, that will hopefully bring peace.
Yeah, it seemed under Trump that the neocons were, I don't want to say they were obsessed with the Middle East. They just seemed to be obsessed with Trump. And then vis-a-vis every move that Trump made in the Middle East, they would just jump on his back for that. So the neocons were 100% consumed by Trump. Now that Trump is not the president, they seem like they don't find the Middle East interesting anymore, like they did, say, under Bush. But they're definitely engaged again with Russia and Ukraine. It seems that their attention has now squarely focused on Russia and Ukraine. It seems like they don't even care about Taiwan and China anymore either. 100% of their focus now is on Ukraine and doing something there, starting a war there. You know, they're not going to take Biden to task for drawing down troops in the Middle East anymore, because they don't care anymore about that. The Middle East was an obsession for them during Bush. It was an obsession for them during Obama as well. But for Trump, it was more a result of Trump trying to remove forces from the Middle East that got the neocons so involved in the Middle East. Now it's like, they seem like they don't have a reason to care about the Middle East anymore. And now they're like Ukraine and Russia. I mean, they're squarely focused on Russia.
Absolutely. Well, they see it indeed. I mean, they don't seem to be able to focus on more than one issue at the same time.
Yeah, they're not good multitaskers.
They're not good multitaskers. And, you know, talking about it like that, one has to ask oneself, because this whole crisis in Ukraine has blown out of nowhere. I mean, as I said, it's odd how it's come about. But, you know, one does wonder whether this is all entirely chance, whether somebody hasn't, in Moscow or Beijing, hasn't figured this out. And they're saying to themselves, well, let's get the neocons fixated with Ukraine again. scare them, to, you know, with threats, non-existent threats of Russian invasions. And the Russians are now playing a game with this. I mean, on the one, you know, they're sort of sometimes hinting that some kind of military action in Ukraine is on the cards, and then they come out and say, oh, no, this isn't our idea at all. And you can see that they're now, in my opinion, smelling the fear, to say it straightforwardly, about a crisis in Ukraine. So that's got the whole US political foreign policy establishment focused on Europe. And at the same time, whilst all that's happening, the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians are able to make big moves in the Middle East because the gaze of the United States is distracted. Now, I'm not sure that this is exactly the plan. I'm not sure that anybody, as I said, in Moscow and Beijing has worked it out like that. But that's almost the effect. And when something like that happens in such a neat way, one almost wonders whether that is the plan. So, you know, you focus on Taiwan, which is the big story in the summer. Then, you know, that sort of slackens off a little. So then you start up with a new thing in Ukraine. The US becomes obsessed with Ukraine. Then you start to dial down Ukraine a little. Nord Stream 2 gets built. All of those starts working, rather, and all that sort of thing happens. Then it's the turn of Taiwan, maybe, to be reactivated as an issue. The focus switches back up to that. And in the meantime, the Middle East slips out of America's control. Maybe somebody's playing that game. I'm not saying they are, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you're dealing with some extremely clever people in Beijing and Moscow. So who knows?
And it seems like the people in Washington are just unable to mount a multi-front pushback against what's going on. But
The problem is you have a weak administration which doesn't have a foreign policy grand strategy. To the extent that it has a grand strategy, it's nonsense. It's things like the
democracy.
Exactly. It's yeah. Exactly.
It's Newland. I
mean, exactly. People like this. So you have Newland, who's interested in Europe. You have this man, Doshi, who's interested in China. But there isn't a single person to bring this all together. And the result is they're losing the diplomatic initiative, the foreign policy initiative. So the Russians are able to dial things up in Europe whenever they want. The Chinese can dial things up in the Middle East. The Chinese can dial things up in the Pacific with Taiwan whenever they want. Countries like Saudi Arabia and, by the way, increasingly India are becoming disillusioned and concerned. And the United States is left firefighting, running from one crisis to another, because the adversaries now hold the diplomatic initiative. They now hold the foreign policy initiative. They can start a crisis in one place, dial it down. They can start another crisis in another place, dial it down. And at the same time, they're able to win pieces, if you like, on the chessboard, as the US remains constantly distracted. As I said, I'm not sure that this is exactly what somebody has planned, but that's the effect. And before very long, the Russians and the Chinese, if they haven't planned it, will work it out that they can do this, and they will do this increasingly, because there is no single person in charge in Washington able to make the decisions, the big decisions, and try to work out some kind of all-encompassing grand strategy that pulls all these things together, as, say, Nixon and Kissinger were able to do in the early 1970s.
Yeah, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, you know, Biden, okay, he's a potato head. Kamala Harris, after witnessing her interviews last week, well, if they haven't figured it out by now, they definitely have now figured it out as far as Kamala Harris is concerned. Then you're left with Blinken, who, to be kind, he's a lightweight, and I'll leave it there. And they already know this. And so what are they left with? In the case of Russia, for example, they're left with, okay, so all these people are incompetent. And who do we have left? Well, we have Victoria Nuland. And we already know that Victoria Nuland is singularly obsessed and fixated on Russia, on destroying Russia. I mean, she's probably got that on her mind 24/7. How do I destroy Russia? That's all she's thinking about. And so they say, okay, let's just let's toy with her. Let's troll. Exactly. Let's troll them. And that's exactly what they're doing. It's not very hard to figure it out.
No, it isn't, exactly. And as I said, in the meantime, India is now cutting big deals with Russia because they've become increasingly disillusioned with the US. They were shocked by the way in which the Afghanistan affair, which, remember, is their neighbourhood, it concerns them, impinges on them directly. They were shocked by the way in which that was mismanaged. And so they're now cutting deals with the Russians. Modi is due to have a joint summit meeting with Putin and Xi at some point. It hasn't yet been fixed when, but apparently it's coming. So they're becoming disillusioned. And of course, the Saudis are too. So, you know, they're not going to break with the US. The Indians and the Saudis have no interest in breaking with the US, but they're starting to make their own decisions. And they're making their own decisions because they sense that there's no grand strategy, there's no overarching plan, because you get people like Victoria Nuland, who is obsessed with Russia. Now she's in the kind of ascendant because the way in which this Ukrainian crisis has been stirred up. And then when she's basically, when that's dialed down, we have people like Doshi, who is obsessed with China, and by the way, Sullivan as well. He's apparently obsessed with China too. So then you can distract them from the Middle East by dialing that up also. And in the meantime, all the big moves have been made, all the big deals have been cut, and the US, as I said, is constantly running around from crisis to crisis, and it's never been given time to stop and think and work out a policy. And of course, there's no single person in charge in Washington who can do it.
Yeah, so I guess the final question, which is on my mind as far as Syria is concerned, and even the Middle East, is the problem is with Turkey that's left.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. Turkey to me looks like the problem that Russia and China have to figure out. And it's related directly with Syria, but also the region in general, which is Erdogan's grand vision of how he sees the Middle East and Europe, which is something that I think Russia and China have to start to deal with.
Absolutely. That is exactly. I mean, Turkey is the wild card, or rather to be not. Let's not talk about Turkey. Erdogan is the wild card because he has this megalomaniac foreign policy, which is contradicting Turkey's economic problems, which are, you know, growing all the time. I mean, there's been a stabilization in the lira because apparently he's been able to bilk some money out of the UAE, so the story goes, and Qatar, but this is only a temporary respite. But this incredibly fragile economy combined with this overarchingly overambitious foreign policy that he has. And I suspect that sooner or later, what's going to happen is that the Chinese and the Russians will, especially the Chinese, will say to Erdogan, look, you can't go on as you are. You've got to make a decision which side you're on, just as Lukashenko has done in Belarus, just as the Kazakhs have been forced to do. They've been forced to make the choice. You've got to make the choice. Either you're with us or you're against us. If you're against us, well, don't expect us to help you when you run into financial problems. And don't expect either that the neocons in Washington are going to cut you much slack. If you're with us, then we might bail you out of your difficulties. Remember, I mean, wouldn't take a vast amount of money from Beijing to help tidy things through in Turkey. I mean, China can afford it. The problem is, as I said, they're not going to give him money when they can't rely on what he's going to do. So they're going to see whether they can nail him down. That's my guess, but we're still some months away from that. And of course, the other problem is that the internal crisis in Turkey is apparently now building, with inflation continuing to grow. And we just can't be sure that Erdogan will survive it anyway.
Yeah, he's his time may be running out. We'll see. He's a survivor. We will see. He is a survivor. All right, let's leave it there. The Duran.locals.com, Odyssey, BitChute, Rumble, and Super User, where you will find us. And that's the Good Day mug right there.
It certainly is.
Use the code Good.
As you can see in use, Earl Grey tea, by the way, just for anybody who's interested. So there you go.
Use that code, 10% off all merch at the Duran shop. Take care.